From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. On Friday, another big rally in Washington, this time against abortion. They call it the March for Life, 1 week after the huge women's march that turned out for abortion rights and more. Tomorrow, President Trump will announce a new Supreme Court nominee. Roe v. Wade is on the table this hour in the On Point 100-day spotlight, abortion, abortion rights, and the Trump presidency. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Have you been marching for abortion, against? What do you see coming under the Trump-Pence administration? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. On Friday, the March for Life rally in Washington. Big crowd there. Vice President Mike Pence, highest-ranking American official ever to attend the rally after 40-plus years of it being there since Roe v. Wade, talked about President Trump's upcoming Supreme Court nomination, alluding to a conservative pick who would want to maybe overturn Roe v. Wade.
President Donald Trump will announce a Supreme Court nominee who will uphold the God-given liberties enshrined in our Constitution in the tradition of the late and great Justice Antonin Scalia.
Antonin Scalia, who had said many times there's no right to abortion in the U.S. Constitution. And it wasn't just Mike Pence, vice president, but Kellyanne Conway was there. White House counselor talked about the Trump administration's commitment, she said, to pro-life policies.
Every day is a fight for life. Yet today is also a celebration of life. It is a time to lift your voices and lift your spirits. Steps away from here in the White House, a president and a vice president sit at their desks and make decisions for a nation. As they sit there, they stand here with you.
They are here with you. And what did that crowd want? Here's just a few of them, the March for Life rally in Washington Friday. Joining me first from Arlington, Virginia, is Ilana Shore, congressional reporter at Politico. She was at the March for Life rally on Friday. Ilana, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
First of all, talk to us about the turnout. You were at the rally the weekend before. Turnout counts are big these days. I don't want to make too much of it, but what kind of turnout was there for this? Was it the 44th time people have turned out for this?
Yes, that's correct. Of course, I am no aerial crowd surveying expert, but
fair
I can
enough.
Say that 50,000 was the estimated number that March organizers told the National Park Service, and I would not be surprised if it actually exceeded that. Perhaps not by too much, but I mean, compared to the 500,000 strong that were present for the Women's March, you know, it's apples and oranges.
Not the same scale, but a big turnout and a lot of enthusiasm. We heard right there in the chanting, "Hey, hey, ho, ho, Roe v. Wade has got to go." Was that the number one message? Was that the upfront message of this rally?
Not just that, actually. Planned Parenthood was perhaps an even bigger target. And that's important because congressional Republicans have a much, much easier time doing something like slashing Planned Parenthood funds this year through law, which they plan to do via the appropriations process.
Mike Pence was there. This has never happened before that we've had a vice president on the scene. Presidents have appeared or called in, but he was actually there. Remind us of Mike Pence's history when it comes to abortion.
He is a very strong and career-long advocate for abortion restrictions. He's been a speaker at the March for Life multiple times in the past since he was a very young congressman from Indiana before becoming governor.
And now there he was as vice president, right out in the middle of the rally, calling out. What were the main messages here? Cut Planned Parenthood funding, and what about the Supreme Court and its membership?
He is very, very focused on getting an opponent of abortion on the Supreme Court. And this is actually, like much that the Trump administration has been doing, it's something that the president promised on the campaign trail. I think it's easy for us to forget that Trump, as Kellyanne Conway has said repeatedly in recent days, is doing nothing but following through on his commitments. And that may upset some folks, but it's not like folks didn't know this was coming.
Did you hear tight conversation between different candidates that Trump may have been considering? He says he's decided now he's going to announce it live on television tomorrow night, as I understand. But were the protesters or the ralliers there, were they focused on exactly who he will put up for the high court?
They were not. And frankly, they were not really even focused on the crowd turnout estimates, even though that's what the media and the public likes to think about, and of course the president too. They were really just excited to have Republicans in complete control of Washington and what that might mean.
Alana Shore was there. Alana, stand by. Emily Bazelon joins us right now from New York, staff writer at the New York Times Magazine, co-host of Slate's Political Gabfest, research scholar at Yale Law School, writes about justice, women's issues. Emily Bazelon, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
Has the tide turned here? What's happening with the national political climate and prospects for change in American policy when it comes to abortion?
Well, Trump's election was a huge victory for abortion opponents. And so the question is, how much has the tide turned? And the Supreme Court pick, which, as you mentioned, is now on the schedule for Tuesday night, is going to be the first big indication of that. And given how clear and strong the administration's promises have been to abortion opponents, it would be very surprising if the new Supreme Court nominee was not someone who the pro-life community applauded.
How do you see the promises that have been made here?
I think that Trump has promised to put justices in the mold of Antonin Scalia on the court. And Scalia, as you said, I mean, he talked about Roe versus Wade as being absurd and was very committed to the idea that the Constitution did not contain any kind of right of access to abortion in it. This is Scalia's seat. That's how the Republicans see it. And so the person for this particular appointment, I think that abortion is really a litmus test for this new nominee we're going to see coming in.
Alana Shore, again, you were there with the with those 50,000 perhaps plus that turned out on Friday. How great their ambitions for this presidency?
Quite great. I would say that a lot of the crowd were younger folks, a lot of college students, 20-somethings. And, you know, their institutional memory is not that vast, so their expectations are naturally high. And they believe that Trump really has sort of turned the corner. Now, this is a guy who in 1999 said he was very pro-choice, but they believe he's really fully come around.
And they were excited to have Mike Pence there with them at the rally in Washington. Alana Shore covered it for Politico. Alana, thank you very much for joining us from Arlington, Virginia today.
Thanks for having me.
Here was then the president in November talking with 60 Minutes. Leslie Stahl asked President Trump, or President-elect, if he would overturn Roe v. Wade. Here was his response.
Having to do with abortion, if it ever were overturned, it would go back to the states. So
yeah,
it would go back to the states.
Some women
states
won't be able to get an abortion.
No, it'll go back to the states.
By state? No, some.
Yeah. Well, they'll perhaps have to go to they'll have to go to another state.
Emily Bazelon, there's a lot to unpack there, but how is that generally interpreted? Does it seem clear that though he was pro-choice for a long time, that President Trump would try to put on the court justices who would overturn Roe v. Wade?
That is certainly the commitment he has made. And this social conservative constituency, which was at the march, which has been really behind Donald Trump unwaveringly, so that this is what they want. And so for that reason, it would just seem very strange for him not to fulfill this promise. We should note that this Supreme Court appointment is not going to tilt the balance on Roe versus Wade, because Scalia was a foe of Roe versus Wade. And if he's replaced by a like-minded justice, that doesn't change the 5-4 split. But the next appointment would have the power to change the balance.
And of course, you know, 4 years is a long time. We have any number of justices who could, in that period, make their way off the court. Do people look who follow this closely, like yourself, Emily, look at 4 years of Donald Trump, if that's what it is, and say, we could see that balance change within this frame of time?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, Justice Kennedy, Justice Ginsburg, Justice Breyer, these are all people in their late 70s or early 80s who've been on the court for a number of years. Any of them are swing votes on abortion. And so the stakes are just, that is what they are. They are very high.
And even if the balance changes, you know, after 40, famously as of Friday's rally, 44 years since the Roe v. Wade ruling, can a court just turn around and say, oh, we were wrong for almost half a century? That's done now?
The court could do that, yes. I mean, there are a few very dramatic moments in American law where that's happened. So Brown versus Board of Education, very different pro-civil rights ruling, but it reversed 50 years of precedent, you know, of the very discredited decision Plessy versus Ferguson that held that separate was equal. Brown said it wasn't, and that was the end of Plessy. And so I think for people who, you know, who vehemently oppose abortion, they are hoping for the same fate for Roe versus Wade. There's another way the court could go about this, which would be more incremental and perhaps more in keeping with the style of Chief Justice John Roberts. But who knows? I mean, that is very much a question of up for grabs. And it's certainly within the court's power to simply reverse Roe.
More incremental in that it what would empower states to put more restrictions? Lots of them have been moving in that direction already on the window of time in which an abortion might be performed?
That's right. And, you know, there was on the other side of this equation a major victory for pro-choice groups last term. We're about to have on the show Amy Hagstrom Miller, whose network of clinics in Texas won this big battle before the Supreme Court. And the Texas laws that were struck down were laws the courts found that were essentially a proxy for forcing clinics to close. They were wrapping clinics in a lot of red tape with unnecessary regulations, and the real motive was not to protect the health of women, as the state of Texas claimed, but really just to shut down abortion clinics. So last term, that was not okay with five members of the court, but you could imagine a different majority reaching a very different kind of result.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about abortion and abortion rights as Donald Trump prepares to nominate a new justice to the United States Supreme Court. You can join us this hour. Did you march in Washington on Friday against abortion? Did you march the week before? And what do you see coming under Donald Trump? Do you think it will be clear this time where the nominee stands on Roe v. Wade? What do you see happening at the state level on abortion? Could you picture Roe v. Wade going down under Donald Trump? Of course, the weekend before, we had almost 500,000 marching in Washington, the Women's March on Washington. Here's some chanting from that weekend.
We are the majority vote! We are the majority vote!
We are the majority vote, but a different view. Last Friday, March for Life, this was Jeanine Mancini talking about the pro-life movement, as she calls it, saying it had been excluded, she said, from the Women's March.
Pro-life is pro-woman. That voice might have been shut out last week, but pro-life is pro-woman.
Roe v. Wade in the bullseye, but also funding for Planned Parenthood. Here was the Vice President of the United States at that rally in Washington on Friday.
This administration will work with the Congress to end taxpayer funding of abortion and abortion providers. And we will devote those resources to health care services for women across America.
Emily Bazelon is with us, staff writer of the New York Times Magazine, host of Slate's Political Gab Fest. Sarin Foster and Amy Hagstrom Miller join us in just a moment. Emily, would you be good enough to walk us through the short list of potential nominees? Donald Trump says he's already decided. We'll learn tomorrow. But who's on that very short list, and what do we know about where they stand on abortion rights?
The most clear, ardent foe of access to abortion is Bill Pryor, who is a federal appeals court judge in Alabama. And he's on the record of talking about Roe versus Wade as an abomination. So it's clear where he stands. There is Judge Diane Sykes. She's on the appeals court in the Midwest that usually sits in Chicago. She hasn't ruled in an abortion case, but she has some decisions in cases protecting the rights of Christian students at a university, for example, and in the Hobby Lobby case about birth control access, she sided with the side of kind of fundamentalist Christianity and religious groups in that case. So I think that abortion opponents really like her for that reason. Then there is Judge Neil Gorsuch out of Denver, another federal appellate judge. He has written a book on assisted suicide in which he opposed physician-assisted suicide. And there's some language in there about the sanctity of human life that, again, abortion opponents applaud. And finally, Judge Hardiman on the Third Circuit in Pennsylvania. And I don't think he's really on the record about abortion. And for that reason, he may not get the nod.
In the conversations, if this goes forward, and of course, some Democrats are saying, look, you wouldn't let us go forward when Barack Obama, President Obama, made his last nomination, his nomination there. We're not going to do it this time. But if it does, and in those hearings, what do you expect to be asked, and how clear can the answers, or historically are the answers, when it comes to what nominees say about what they would do on Roe v. Wade?
I'm sure senators will try to ask this question, and the nominee will deflect, will just refuse to answer, and will say, I can't discuss anything that could come up in a pending case before me. The last few nominations, the closest we've gotten to abortion is talking about an older Supreme case called Griswold versus Connecticut that said that married couples had the right to buy birth control. I think that's from the 50s, if I'm remembering correctly, maybe the early 60s. And so it has a right to privacy in it. And so you can say, I think that, you know, we should uphold Griswold versus Connecticut at this point without really signaling what you think about Roe versus Wade. And I'm sure all of the nominees will sidestep any kind of direct question about abortion.
We can certainly, though, see the impulse of Vice President Mike Pence. He was at the rally on Friday during the presidential campaign. Here he was in the one VP debate, talked enthusiastically about running with what he called a pro-life presidential candidate, Donald Trump.
A society can be judged by how it deals with its most vulnerable, the aged, the infirm, the disabled, and the unborn. I believe it with all my heart, and I couldn't be more proud to be standing with a pro-life candidate in Donald Trump.
Not always, but that's how he was described during the campaign. That's where he put himself during the campaign. Yesterday, interview with Fox News Sunday, here was Kellyanne Conway again. She was asked whether or not President Trump's Supreme Court nominee would look to overturn Roe v. Wade.
I can guarantee you that the promise that candidate Trump made will continue as president, that he's a pro-life president, and he assumes that he will, well, he has promised that he will appoint pro-life judges, including to the Supreme Court.
He has promised, says Kellyanne Conway. Emily Bazelon, please stand by in New York. Amy Hagstrom-Miller joins us now from Charlottesville, Virginia, founder and president of Whole Women's Health. It's a group of women's health clinics, provides holistic health care, including abortions. In a 2016 Supreme Court case, Whole Women's Health argued against the state of Texas over abortion restrictions that hurt abortion clinics. Whole Women's Health won. Amy Hagstrom-Miller, thanks very much for being with us today.
Thanks so much, Tom. Glad to be here.
Good to have you. And from Alexandria, Virginia, Sarin Foster joins us. She is president of Feminists for Life, a feminist organization that does not support Roe v. Wade. Sarin Foster, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom.
Sarin, how do you see the climate changing when it comes to abortion rights under President Donald Trump?
Well, I think that after seeing last weekend and having 40 other events across the country, other marches, March for Life events, and in France, you see that people really are very high on hope, thinking that that there's a chance, a real chance, to protect women and children from abortion because of their belief that women deserve better than abortion, and because they've seen what has happened to women and men who've survived being aborted. They've seen their faces because of the information about fetal development. They think that there's a lot of information out there now that really has affected, you know, young students. So you've got a real energy, and it's coming from our college students, frankly. And then combine that with the leadership changes that you have a pro-life, you know, House as well as Senate, a lot of governors, as well as the president. It's there's a lot of hope within the pro-life movement, and it's electric. It's you know, thinking about the fact that the Senate may be able to confirm a pro-life member, although you can never guarantee what a justice will think. Just look back most recently at John Roberts on his votes on Obamacare. A lot of people thought because they assumed he would vote in a pro-life way that he would vote against Obamacare. The House is going to be looking at other efforts. They're going to be leading the efforts to defund abortions. They'll be looking at the pain-capable abortion ban that would prohibit abortions on those smallest human beings 20 weeks into their development that can feel pain. Others will be looking at anti-coercion laws. We'll be looking at the state level. Feminists for Life is very interested in prohibiting rapists, convicted rapists, from getting access to their own children by forcing visitation rights.
So, Sarah, you say that the whole scene is electric with hope. Define that hope. Hope for what?
They think that pro-lifers think that they have a great chance of passing different pieces of legislation at the state as well as national level on a variety of fronts because of the numbers.
Amy Hextra-Miller, how do you see the what? The security, if from your perspective, perhaps, of abortion rights in this country as we sit here at the beginning of 2017?
Well, Tom, we are coming off one of the strongest Supreme Court wins in a generation with the whole woman's health case this past summer. We challenged the Texas laws that restricted women's access to abortion. And as you know, we made it all the way to the Supreme Court.
Yep.
And had a very favorable decision that struck down many things that the state was trying to do and basically, you know, ruled in clear and uncertain terms that unless regulations further women's health and safety, the state does not have interest stepping in and curbing women's access to a safe abortion care. And I think one of the things we need to realize about Roe, a couple things. One, Roe didn't happen for everybody. There are still many people throughout the country whose access to safe abortion care is curbed and restricted by the regulations that have happened state by state since the Casey decision. And two, you know, people always think that abortion started with Roe. Safe abortion started with Roe. And women and families have always needed access to safe abortion care in order to take care of their families and take care of their bodies in the best way. And so I feel really strongly that we came off a win that's going to give us strength in the states. Eight states beyond Texas have already used our win this past summer in order to strike down targeted regulations of abortion providers in their states. And the current polling shows that over 70% of Americans support Roe at this time.
Amy, it was a big win that your whole women's health group found there in the Supreme Court. But of course, the membership of the court is changing. Justice Scalia, already gone, of course, for some time now, that empty seat there, the possibility of more. Donald Trump saying he's going to be appointing or nominating someone tomorrow. Do you fear? Can you imagine Roe v. Wade actually being overturned, Amy?
So, you know, we won 5-3. So we would have won no matter what happens with this seat, with Justice Scalia's seat. And I think that's an important thing to notice, that we had Kennedy ruling in our favor, and that for a long time now, the court has voted again and again to uphold Roe v. Wade. And contrary to sort of popular spin, it is not common for the court to go against its precedent. There's 44 years of precedent here that I think keeps us strong. I do think people talk about this a lot, and Trump is familiar to me, having owned and operated and managed and worked in clinics in Texas for a long time now. You know, this archetype is very familiar, this person who was elected not by a majority, but who takes that power and that opportunity to try to curb women and families' access to safe health care by any means necessary. And I think we need to watch and be sure that we can uphold that women's health and safety is paramount and that there's not you know, people stepping in to curb people's access and creating what really, Tom, is now, you know, has really shaken down to be two different Americas already across the country, where you have some states with so much restriction that women have a right on paper that they can't actually realize in their lives. And then other states where access is supported and women can count on safe health care.
Two different Americas, but of course, one high court ultimately. If they would change, what a change. Amy Hextra-Miller doesn't think it's coming. Sarah Foster talks about electric hope in the anti-abortion community. Emily Bazelon is with us, and lots of callers for the three of you. Anna in Omaha, Nebraska. Anna, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Sure. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Just a small clarification. The two positions are not pro-life versus pro-abortion. No one is pro-abortion. The positions are pro-choice.
Yes.
Versus pro-life.
Understood. And Roe v. Wade is what makes that choice possible. Do you fear that that choice is really under threat in a Trump administration era, Anna?
Absolutely.
But my guests are saying, well, it's complicated. You know, the 5-3 vote already went for Amy's group last year. Maybe the risk is we've got 40 years plus of precedent here. Does that not, if you're pro-choice, it sounds like, Anna, does that not give you comfort?
I'm very much pro-choice. I don't think there's any comfort anywhere these days when we see the decisions that were made recently about refugees and the moves forward. It's hard to believe that there'd be a more reasoned approach toward this really important topic.
So not feeling the confidence right there. Amy, Anna, I appreciate your call. Kristen in San Marcos, Texas. Kristen, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. So I am pro-choice. I have an issue with the pro-life platform because it really it looks at a short-term solution for a long-term problem. Because if we were to get rid of every single chance at abortion, that doesn't mean abortions are going to stop. I mean, we've seen a historical list of how many at-home abortions that people have tried, because there's a reason why women are, they need that choice for a reason, because it is for their health. I mean, if we're talking about protecting a woman's health, I mean, and we're trying to close what they're calling abortion clinics, they're not just abortion clinics, they're women's health clinics. They allow screenings, they allow the opportunity for a woman to make the choice for her own body and for her own health, and it seems a little short-sighted to just say that abortion, banning abortion is better for a woman's health, because I mean, that's not something that you go after with a hammer, which seems to be Trump's, motive.
Kristen, we've got it, and I appreciate your call as well. Sarah Foster, from where you stand against abortion, what about all the women in this country, all the people, but women in particular, who say, look, I need... This is necessary for the health of the mother. This is a choice I ought to have. Are you prepared to just say, no, forget it, that's history? And what about our caller's concern that means women will seek abortions, even so, at the risk to their own lives?
You're going to be surprised, but I'm going to say I agree with much of what the caller said, and that's why Feminists for Life has a very different mission than most of the pro-life movement. Our mission is to systematically eliminate the reasons that drive women to abortion, lack of resources and support. So we're focused on ending the feminization of poverty. 75% of women who have abortions are poor and low income. More than half of the women who have abortions are already mothers. They know they can't feed that child. They think they won't get the help they need. Feminists for Life's focus is workplace accommodations, education opportunities, and paternal support.
But would you take away the choice? You would, right? I mean, you're against...
Feminists for Life is not an organization that works on the legal front to end abortion. It is to end abortion through Roe v. Wade. We do it through working with our feminist sisters on economic issues, fighting the family cap, Violence Against Women Act, child support enforcement, etc. We were the inspiration for the Pregnancy Assistance Fund, which was to grant schools resources and support so that women and men wouldn't feel driven to drop out of school, as Sarah Weddington, who...
Would you support a nominee who would strike down Roe v. Wade?
Feminists for Life, even before our former vice president of Feminists for Life, Jane Roberts, even before her husband became Chief Justice of the United States Supreme Court, Feminists for Life decided that we were not legal experts. There were other groups who did it, and the unifying organizational principle was resources and support. We don't want to sit there and try to imprison women. That's not our goal. Our goal is to free women from abortion, because women deserve better. And the opportunities before us that I hope we don't miss is for feminist sisters to unite around these ideas that we can solve problems that women face, and they do not have to suffer an abortion, including coerced abortions. There are so many things where we...
But in Washington on Friday, I got the feeling there's a lot of people who would be happy to go ahead and see Roe v. Wade go ahead, whether or not all those problems are solved. We'll come back and look at that. Sarah Foster with Feminists for Life, Amy Hagstrom Miller, president of Whole Women's Health, and Emily Bazelon with us from Slate's Political Gabfest. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about abortion and abortion rights as Donald Trump, President Trump, prepares to nominate a new justice to the United States Supreme Court. He's saying he will do it tomorrow night, and there's a lot on the line when it comes to reproductive health. What do you see coming under President Trump on the abortion front? Could you picture Roe v. Wade going down under Donald Trump? Emily Bazelon is here, senior research scholar at Yale Law School. She's written a lot about justice and women's issues, joins us today from New York. Sarah Foster is here, president of Feminists for Life. She was at the March for Life rally on Friday in Washington. Amy Hagstrom Miller is with us, founder and president of Whole Women's Health. They challenged a clampdown by the state of Texas on health care clinics, abortion clinics, and won before the U.S. Supreme Court. All with us today. Lots of response online here. Toby writes, wait, we are still debating this. Keep your hands off women's vaginas. Suzanne writes, reducing the number of abortions is cheap and easy. Support Planned Parenthood. Since the Congress keeps trying to kill Planned Parenthood, they show they're not really interested in the health and welfare of either women or children. Emily Bazelon, what about Planned Parenthood and the security of its funding with this all-Republican majority Congress?
Well, the Republicans have been talking about defunding Planned Parenthood. There may be some legal problems with singling out one organization in that way. And as you were just talking about, most of what Planned Parenthood does has to do with other aspects of women's health, not abortion. And Planned Parenthood is a huge provider of access to birth control in this country. You know, to make the obvious point, if you really want to reduce the number of abortions, then improving access to birth control is really important. And one of the more promising developments in the last few years has been the increase in the use of long-acting birth control, like IUDs or patches that really do cut down on unwanted pregnancies in a way that really helps women plan in their lives when they want to have children.
Amy Hagstrom-Miller, do you see that funding as under real threat now? And if it should go away, we've heard a lot of talk from Mike Pence and others about how, look, we will focus on women's health. Don't worry. The women's health provision will be provided for in alternative ways.
So I think there are many of us that do full-spectrum family planning care, including abortion care, in this country. And I think the funding that they're targeting is, you know, Title 10 funding, Title 20 funding that really reaches and supports some of the most needy in our communities who get left behind by other healthcare, you know, healthcare plans. In Texas, we have the largest number of uninsured people in this country. And the family planning programs, as well as the abortion access in Texas, has been decimated. And so as a result of that, what we have is the highest maternal mortality rate. It's equal to some developing countries in the state of Texas. It was just said that Texas is actually dangerous for women to carry a pregnancy to term. So I think this is the kind of thing we're looking at when we take a look at Indiana under Mike Pence and we see that women's access to health care was decimated. You know, it's important for us to realize that Planned Parenthood does about 20-30% of the abortions in this country, and those of us who run independent abortion clinics in the country do about 70-80% of the care. And most all of us, Planned Parenthood and the independent clinics, provide full family planning care, and we provide services to our communities that are greatly needed by the women and families all across America. And so I think most Americans understand this and know this and understand that a full range of women's health care is what's needed. I think it's important to also just acknowledge that, of course, I share many values with Sarin, who spoke earlier. When we talk about feminism, when we talk about keeping women at the center of healthcare decisions, and I think it's important for us to notice that unplanned pregnancy is really the problem here, and abortion is one of the solutions to an unplanned pregnancy. And women need to be given those options in order to make the choices that are best for their families and their lives. In order for us to reach our full humanity as women and equal rights, we need to be able to have control over our reproductive lives as well.
Sarah Foster, I'll bring it to you in a moment, but a couple of calls here first, if I may. April in Rapid City, South Dakota. April, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to make a comment about the effect of how our country with the pro-choice Roe v. Wade gives impression to young people that no matter what they do in their lives, however reckless or whatnot they do, that they can always just go out and get an abortion, as opposed to having to learn that they need to be in control of themselves and their actions, and that
It's important education. It's very important education. There's no question about it. But where does that leave you coming down on whether or not abortion should ultimately be available, April?
Well, it should definitely be known that it's taboo. I think that's what gets lost in our country a little bit, because we have so much privacy, which is good, but in some regards, it's not, that it's not a good thing to do. And it's not good for you, a woman. It's not really good for the bigger picture in life. And, you know, it should be highly avoided. And that when you have an unplanned pregnancy, perhaps you don't know everything at that time, and nobody ever really does, and maybe that was God's will. I just want to say that.
Would you support President Trump then nominating a justice and support the, you know, confirming of that justice to the Supreme Court who might be willing to overturn Roe v. Wade, April?
Yes, I would, because I think it's been really extreme in our country for quite a while, and that, you know, extremes are met with extremes, and sometimes you need the other extreme to fix something. So that's my opinion right now.
April, we've got it, and I appreciate your call. One more, Fort Campbell, Kentucky. Sierra is calling. Hi, Sierra, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm pro-choice, vehemently so, and it affected me and my husband both in a very dramatic way. Last year, we found out that we were pregnant, and we were extremely excited about this pregnancy.
Yeah.
We got our anatomy scan done prior to Christmas of last year, and we found out the day after Christmas that our son had serious issues that they couldn't identify at that moment. We got sent to a specialist at Vanderbilt, and over the course of the next 2 weeks, we found out that our son had trisomy 13, which is also known as Patau syndrome, and it is fatal. There is no surviving it. There's nothing you can do about it. Most doctors won't even help take care of an infant if it's born alive with the condition.
So what did you do, Sierra? What did you do?
Well, we wanted to get an abortion when we had a final diagnosis, but because of the term limits in Tennessee, we were unable to get an abortion in Tennessee. So our doctor gave us information to go to Atlanta, Georgia. But we called, we found out the abortion was going to be close to $3,000. We'd have to stay in Atlanta for the course of 2 days, I believe, because you have to have a prior appointment.
Yep, yep.
And then we ran the risk of our baby being too large and being considered over term limit in Georgia.
Okay.
So we were forced to continue on with the pregnancy. At 32 weeks, I had to be induced because I had severe preeclampsia. And we had our son on March 3rd, and he passed away about an hour later. And going through that was probably the most devastating thing that my husband and I have ever been through in our entire lives, in our family. We had so many people in the hospital room there for support. And although we were happy we got to meet our son, I think both of us would have made a different decision had we been able to. But you also have to take into consideration, most people don't have jobs or the financial support or the family support to go through such a high-risk pregnancy. I was going to doctor's appointments once or twice a week for 3 months before we had our son Bishop.
So what would you say to President Trump? What would you say to President Trump, Sierra, as he's preparing to announce a Supreme Court nominee?
In the end, abortion is between a woman and her doctor and her care provider. I don't care why someone needs an abortion. I don't care how many times they've had an abortion, because in the end, those who abuse it should not be the reason why people who really need it or truly would benefit from it should not be able to have readily access to a safe and affordable abortion.
Sierra, stick with us. Sarah and Foster, what do you make of this story? Is this the future for American women, sort of wandering between states as a pregnancy advances? You heard Sierra's challenge there, trying to find a way to deal with a pregnancy that's not working and not being able to in the end.
Well, first of all, I want to say, you know, how sorry I am for her loss. I mean, I think that everybody, no matter where you are on the abortion debate, everybody should feel for her, and I bet every one of your listeners does. There is an interesting bit of legislation in Louisiana that really talks in a different way. If they saw the court was overturned, that they would not criminalize women, that they would offer them help whether they found an abortion or not. And I think that that's the way some of the states are going to go. I'm not really here to promote women wandering around the world looking for an abortion. I don't want women to get near the place. I don't want to see any more women dying from legal but lethal abortion like Cree Irwin and many other women, Holly Patterson. I mean, there's a laundry list of, long list of women who've died from legal abortion, including a teacher who thought she was doing the best.
Yeah, but compared to before it was legal, where it was done all back alley, surely it's a far smaller portion face that fate.
We don't really know because the numbers were made up. Because there was no statistics back then.
Well,
we knew that there were women who died from illegal abortion as well as illegal abortion.
Well, we can use, it's not hard to apply logic to that. Emily, do we have a patchwork coming here? Maybe Roe v. Wade doesn't get knocked down. But we see states erecting, despite Amy Hackstrom Miller's success in Texas, states erecting all kinds of barriers here. The story of Sierra, is that the future for American women?
It is a possible future, and as Amy said earlier, there already is somewhat of a patchwork. And when there isn't easier access to abortion in this country, the people who have the most trouble accessing it are people who don't have the means. Sierra did a very moving job of illustrating the cost of obstructing access to abortion, and she also pointed out that it was a really hard story to listen to, but in some ways she was fortunate because she had the resources and the support to go through such a high-risk pregnancy. But women who have to travel, spend a couple of days getting an abortion, if you have kids to take care of at home, and most women who get abortions actually are mothers, all of that can be a real challenge, especially for poor people.
Sierra, I really appreciate your call. Thank you so much for bringing it to us. Courtney in Atlanta, Georgia. Courtney, thank you for calling. You're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I was talking about the idea that a lot of people that decide to say that they are pro-life often want to also take away the right to birth control down the line. There was a woman on CNN recently that they got to basically admit that what she really wanted was to take away birth control altogether. And so I think that there is a fundamental kind of push to take away women's reproductive rights to kind of reinforce some biblical punishment for sexual freedom.
Sarah Foster, are you sympathetic to that concern? Is it a concern of yours as Feminists for Life?
I don't see that, but that's not who would join Feminists for Life. Mostly you're talking about fundamental evangelical Christians, I think. Maybe Catholics who are well-educated about natural family planning and believe that there, or people who oppose hormones within their body, that sort of thing. So, there are certainly people who believe that, but, from my point of view, what I see from the pro-life movement, I've met one person who believes in throwing women into jail for having an abortion. And I don't really...
Donald Trump said he might support that, right?
Yeah, yes, I know. That was quite shocking to the entire pro-life movement. And you saw that backlash, that kind of shock, because of he hasn't been entrenched in the movement. He hasn't gone through that kind of evolution where a lot of people think of a lot of things. And you see people changing their minds on a lot of different peripheral issues when somebody comes new into a movement. I don't know his heart. I really don't. But within Feminists for Life, we have a spectrum of beliefs about contraception, natural family planning, certain situations where things are better than others. And it's outside our mission because we focus on, preventing women from even thinking about abortion by giving them what they want. I mean, again, we've got to remember we're talking about people. Usually this is an economic issue, and we keep on focusing our energy on abortion instead of elevating the status of women in the United States. Mm. This is a wealthy country. Why is it that a million times a year a woman feels like she has to lay down and sacrifice her child or take a bitter pill and call it choice?
Amy Hackstrom Miller, how do you answer that question? Why is it?
I really appreciate some of your callers. This has been very interesting to listen to Sierra and April and the woman from San Marcos. And I think what we have here is that restricting access to abortion doesn't change the need for abortion as a solution to unplanned pregnancy. And here's where we really have to, you know, to suss out the differences. Access to robust family planning, to preventative health education in schools, these are the things that have been proven research-wise to lead to a reduction in unplanned pregnancy, whether it's in Colorado to look at their program, whether it's in Scandinavia to look at their program. It's not about restricting access and closing clinics. I think April, one of your previous callers, you know, has a stereotype and a stigma that's been put forward that somehow people who have abortions are young, irresponsible women. You know, over 60% of the women that we serve in abortion clinics in this country are mothers already. These are people who are making decisions about their lives and their families, and they're considering their healthcare decisions very, very seriously and fully understanding the implications of whatever decision they might make. And so what you hear from Sierra and you hear from the woman in San Marcos is that people have to travel from state to state to get access, or like we've seen in Texas, people are taking matters into their own hands and using self-administered abortion outside of a clinical setting because the access to abortion has been curbed, but the need for it is still there. And that's where we come in as healthcare providers.
Emily Bazelon, Donald Trump has been on both sides of this question over time. Mike Pence has been solid. Is Mike Pence really driving policy on this from the White House now?
I don't know the answer to that, but I think that however Donald Trump has waffled in the past and wherever his heart might lie, it doesn't really matter. If as a president you have a constituency that you've made a promise to and they're important to your success and you bring in people from that pro-life world, then the chances are you're going to keep the promises you have made in that domain.
Well, we may know very soon. The president's saying he'll announce his nominee for the U.S. Supreme Court tomorrow. Really appreciate the three of you being with us today to think about the implications on the abortion and abortion rights front. Emily Bazelon, New York Times Magazine and Slate's Political Gabfest, thank you very much for being with us, Emily.
Thanks for having me.
Sarin Foster at Feminists for Life, thank you for joining us, Sarin.
My pleasure, Tom.
And Amy Hagstrom Miller, president of Whole Woman's Health, thank you for being with us, Amy.
Absolutely. Thank you, Tom.
Listeners, thanks to all, our callers especially. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.